Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. And tonight it's the start of Stag Do season, is actually what I'm going to call it. It is the first Stag Do of 2022, and there's a lot of Stag Do's to come. However, first up, first one through the door, will all be revealed in just one moment. But when we discuss, or when I introduce the co-host, I think it'll be pretty obvious whose Stag Do it is. So first of all, King of Stag Do's, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, you've had hundreds and been on hundreds of these Football Time Stag Do's. Can you hear me, Stephen?
You might have to do that one again, Stu. I think the internet kind of crashed for half a second. I was sat here thinking, I hope that one's for Aiden. And then I'm thinking, I'm counting the silence, kind of like, we're up to seven. That was meant for me. I haven't got a clue what Stu's said there.
What I'm going to do is,
it's going to be a long night.
I am going to leave all of that in, but I'm just going to reduce the silence.
Oh yeah, leave that. Yeah, we'll get Lewis to leave that in.
Yeah,
we'll take a guess at that. Yeah.
So from the top, you know, if technically we are cutting it all out, which we're really not. My question was, you've been on. You've had loads of Stag Do's, and you've been on loads of these Football Time Stag Do's, and this is the first one of 2022. Are you looking forward to them?
Oh yes, there's nothing better than a TFT Stag Do for a book. You know, we're clocking them up now. We must be close to about 15 or 20 or so of these now. And I think for me, I really appreciate being on this side of that particular divide. Because you know how, I don't know, at least temporarily uncomfortable it is for the first 5 minutes or so until you kind of like get into your stride. It must be as close to feeling like walking to that chair on Mastermind as anything could be via a TFT podcast.
That's good, because I thought you were going to say like the electric chair. Was where I thought that was going.
If Lewis can kind of like tag on the Mastermind theme tune to the start of this podcast, then that would be perfect.
I'm not going to lie, with that intro, we are anything but masterminds. I'm just going to put that out there. So it's a great link, though. We're now back in the game. So a great link because, like you say, that first, when you sat this side of the Stag Do, and I've only ever done it once, I've only ever had one Stag Do. And the next co-host has got his Stag Do coming really soon, and he's never been on the other side of it. He's always been a guest or, like, groomsman or chief usher of the Stag Do. Aidan Williams, are you feeling the pressure yet for your own?
Absolutely. I know I think it'll be different to going on and talking about another part about your book, because it's the familiarity, it's the people you normally talk to, but you're not normally the one getting all the grilling. You know, you get the odd little curveball from you, Stu, I'm not gonna lie, but having a whole pod full of them, that's a whole other thing. So yes, I've got a few more weeks to wait for that, thank goodness, so I can psych myself up and we can point the glare of the bright lights at somebody else tonight.
It'll soon come round, by the way, don't worry. You think you've got weeks and then all of a sudden it's the night before.
Yes.
Okay, so let's get to the groom. It's whose Stag Do it is, and to be fair, this guy's also been on 100 Stag Do's too. The book is out of the blue. It is the tale of Chelsea's unlikely Champions League campaign of 2012. It's going to come as no surprise that the author is Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, is this your 498th book?
Sometimes it feels like it might. It's the sixth one, this one has been brewing in my mind for I was going to say 10 years. It can't really be 10 years, can it? Because it's been 10 years since the event, but it's a story that's I've had in my mind for about 4 or 5 years at least, and it just needed to be done. And you know, for many reasons, But yeah, it's this. I mean, all my books tend to be a labor of love. I mean, one of the things we've said on pods in the past is, you know, write about something that you really are interested in, because otherwise it doesn't sound, you know, you can't tell a tale of something you're not interested in. And I was passionately interested in this one.
So we'll dive straight in. So first of all, as with all Centre Circle podcasts / stag do's, it's your chance not to sell your book. Your books don't need selling anymore when you're a JK Rowling of the football world, but when it's your chance to sort of inform, tell what this book, you know, we've said it's the campaign, but it's so much more than that. So just give us a flavour of what this book is.
Okay, well, I sort of pick up the story in 2008 when Chelsea played Man United in the Champions League final in Moscow, and Terry had the penalty to win the trophy and slipped, and it goes on from there, and how, you know, Grant got the sack, and, you know, I start with sort of Avram Grant, and if the ball goes in the net, Avram Grant gets a new contract. Terry slips and he gets the sack, and it just seems so crazy that, you know, on a little patch of rain, did one man's job hang? And he takes the story from there to the various managers who came and went in the intervening years, until we got to 2012 when Villas Boas was appointed to Chelsea. And it tells a story that season, basically. So it's a season where Chelsea were in such, at one stage, just a tailspin of decline, the worst season they'd had in the Abramovich era, and how the crazy number of things that happened that they stretched credit credulity to breaking points, that they sort of survived, won the FA Cup, and then went and won the Champions League in the most unexpected, unlikely, just crazy way. And basically, that's the tale. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to speak to Sky TV, who wonderfully led me to access some old archives of the programmes they had about it. And there's one part where Lampard's been interviewed, and he says something along the lines of, I'm not sure the exact quote, if a Hollywood scriptwriter had submitted this story to his studio, and he got laughed out of the place because it's too fantastic to be true. And it is. When I say fantastic, I mean fantasy-like. To be true, and it is. I mean, there's been other Champions League's triumphs. Liverpool coming back from 3-0 down against Milan. Man United rescuing and then winning the game in the last minute against Barcelona. But the whole tonnage of unexpected events, unlikely events, things you couldn't possibly think were going to happen, that led to Chelsea winning that Champions League trophy, demanded a story, and so I wrote it.
I mean, obviously, we've all had the pleasure of an early release. We've all read it. You know, we all know the content and the depth and the level that you go into. And we will come. Obviously, we'll come to that during our chat, during the podcast. But Stephen, you're a great one for setting the scene of a story, either decades earlier or years earlier, or depending on the context of the tale that you're telling. But I suppose very rarely does a story have not a definitive start, but, you know, Gareth, the start that Gary's picked, that slip, it's literally not even a second of time where you can start a story. They don't come along very often, a pinpoint moment to start a story.
Not very often, you know, and it's certainly not to be able to get one that swings so pronounced manner from one extreme to the other. You know, what a ridiculous way to lose a Champions League final. Yet the punchline still comes kind of like 4 years later, and it is, you know, an utterly ridiculous way to win the Champions League. Not just, you know, the final itself, but, you know, for so much of what precedes the final. So, yeah, you know, it is a case of casting your eye across the landscape and saying, look, where do the roots of this take hold, and yeah, you know, there's no better for this particular story. You know, there is no better starting point than that night in Moscow, unless, you know, you could feasibly take it back to kind of like Luis Garcia, I suppose. That would have been that would have been lovely.
Nicely played. Aiden.
Well, that was a bit of a slide tackle. I was listening to the South American Files podcast we did, just as a reminder, someone that it was it who tweeted.
Gary Walker
tweeted saying, yeah, how ruthless it was. And I think, yeah, was it really that bad?
I don't really listen to the
podcast back all that often, but yeah, I thought, no, I'm going to have to listen to this soon. I'm thinking, oh, good God.
Yeah, you are literally the most hated man in England.
I think the spirit of that podcast has brought Luis Garcia into play.
Aiden, for you, you don't need to offend anyone. It's up to you. You can just leave that. Stephen is really good at it. But for you, like we said, it has its point of genesis with that slip by John Terry. And to be fair, it couldn't have happened to a nicer fella. But in terms of the story and the point that Gary made and the point that sort of, via Frank Lampard, the story, we've said it so many times, and to be fair, Gary is a football fiction writer as well, but just sometimes fact is so much better than fiction.
Especially in sport as well, because it just turns up these freak occurrences in some ways, or a string of them in this case, I guess, is what leads you through. And the mention of Liverpool, because Stephen brought it up, not me, that there are some similarities to that 05. I think in terms of, the last gasp goal for Liverpool to get out of the group, and there's several close shaves for Chelsea on the way, the dramatic semi-final, dare I mention it? Well, dare I mention what Stephen mentioned, I should say. And so on, Chelsea had that this time around, less controversially, but very, very dramatic. So there's lots of those similarities, but it's the unlikelihood of stringing them all together, and especially in a fairly short time frame, and for a team that weren't at the peak at that point either. This was Chelsea, who missed out on qualifying for the Champions League by the conventional means, so they had to find another way, and they sure did. But that just shows that this wasn't the best Chelsea team there's been in the last 10, 12 years by any stretch, and yet it's the one who managed to find the strength of character, strength of will, the fortune, I guess, and the ability to take the luck when it came along to find a way to get to the biggest prize of them all. And it is truly remarkable. And many, many better teams will get close and fail. Better Chelsea teams have gone closer and failed than this one. But this makes it more dramatic, and it's far more dramatic than Chelsea's season winning it last year. This is a far more interesting tale, probably even more so for Chelsea fans because it was their first, of course. But even if this was a second or third Champions League, I still think that the sheer drama of this would outweigh a more conventional trophy win, if you like. And that's what sport throws up, and I think football manages to throw it up even more than some other sports sometimes. Or maybe that's just our bias that we like to think that. I certainly do, because the best team doesn't always win in football. There's more than some other sports a little more predictable. I don't want to sort of castigate them all, but I think football has so many different ways you can do things, and the different ways you can mitigate against ability or circumstance, like we'll get to in terms of Chelsea in the semi-final. They were outdone on ability, if we're being fair, and also outdone in numbers, and they still found a way. And that's the drama, and that's the beauty.
That's brilliant by you, Aiden. Because I was going to ask Gary what his rationale for writing the book was, but I feel like Aiden just answered it for you, Gary. However, in all seriousness, obviously, as regular listeners will know, passionate Chelsea fan. Was it? Okay, here's a question for you. Would you have written this book if it hadn't been about Chelsea?
One big point that I meant to mention when you said about the starting point is the reason Terry took that penalty was because Drogba had been sent off, should have been Drogba taking the penalty. So it was a nice starting point for Drogba not being there to 4 years after Drogba having the last kick of his Chelsea contract, because he was leaving the club afterwards, to round out the story. Because to go back to your question, I think the story stands on its own. I've had a few sort of pods about the book and various sort of questions led me to think about this. I'm not a Chelsea fan, I genuinely can't think of any European Cup or Champions League campaign where a club has won it, where there's been so much craziness involved. Now, I mean, obviously, as you know, as Stevie mentioned, you know, and Aidan sort of mentioned as well, there's the Liverpool had that last gasp against Olympiacos to caboose some goal and then come back in the final. But that's two games. In this, there's 10. I mean, I don't know. Almost every game was ridiculous. So it's the most, for me, and I say, forget that I'm a Chelsea fan, for me, it's the most compelling Champions League campaign story in the history of the Champions League or the European Cup. If somebody's going to chuck one out that's got more drama involved, then I'd be impressed, because I've gone back and looked at this a couple of times since, and it's just a ridiculous story. And as I say, you know, so to answer your question, the story needed writing, whether it was Chelsea or not, but the fact that it was meant I could do it in blue ink.
Well, actually, as luck would have it, we happen to have a guy who's written a book about the European Cup. So, yeah. Stephen, question for you. Is this, and as Gary says, is this the most sensational campaign? Like I said, there may have been more dramatic finals, you know, there may have been even more dramatic semi-finals, but maybe one or two games in an entire campaign. But is this campaign the most sensational when you look at it from start to finish?
I think what makes this story is it's dysfunctionality. That's what comes down to it. It's the sheer dysfunctional nature of it. And that's, you know, then this is what it has in common with Liverpool and 2005, is that it shouldn't have happened. There's a myriad of reasons why it shouldn't have happened. Yet by some force of will, it happened. And, you know, it's up there with the most dysfunctional. And that's the story that makes it. If Chelsea simply, like Aidan said the other, you know, last season, you know, there's no great interest in Chelsea winning that. You know, for Chelsea fans, huge amount of interest. But for the, you know, the casual viewer, there just isn't the story. There isn't the intrigue in it. Whereas for the 10 years ago, this was a ridiculously dysfunctional story. And the fact that, I don't know, that's a Chelsea squad, that's a Chelsea side that should be able to win the Champions League, but they go about it in the most ludicrous of fashions. You know, they conspire against themselves, yet they overcome them. It's almost a case of them overcoming themselves as much as it is their opponents. And, you know, this is why it's such a likeable run. You know, this is, you know, even if you're not a Chelsea supporter, you know, you buy into this book, you read it, and you get behind them, and you want them to prevail. You kind of, you know, all kind of partisanship falls away as you're reading it. And because it's written from a Chelsea supporter's perspective, it's also got that, I don't know, that kind of passion behind it and that eye of the beholder. And I think only a supporter of a club could write this particular book, you know, from this particular, standpoint, you know, and it is sheerly down to the dysfunctional nature in which they traverse this success that makes it what it is. Because you look at the cast of names, you look at the money spent, you know, they should be more than capable of winning this competition through, you know, the squad that they are, the talent that they have, and, you know, all of the, all of the advantages almost. You know, there's everything that would, by rights, facilitate Chelsea winning this. It's almost like no surprise that they win it, yet it is a complete and utter surprise about how they go about doing so. It is completely out of character. And that's why it stood alone for almost a decade until that second success last year, as this almost an anomaly. But it is just down to the utter brilliance of just how dysfunctional it is. that makes her.
Right, I've got a question for you, Adam. Is this a story that could only be told against the backdrop of the Champions League rather than the European Cup?
Interesting. I guess so. I mean, if we're talking the second half of it, then that would in some ways be the same as the European Cup because it's the knockout and how they got through there. But if it was back in the European Cup days, Chelsea would have been up against the champions of Switzerland or the champions of Sweden or something like that. Not wanting to be rude to those countries in particular, but, you know, a lesser level of ability in terms of domestic clubs. So therefore, what you were mentioning earlier about, you know, more dramatic finals, and sure, yeah, there was very late drama and so on in this, but there's been more dramatic matches than this one in terms of a European Cup final. But across the campaign, I don't think you'd get this number of close calls or this number of ways of scraping a way through from a tricky situation against a elite opponent than you would do in a Champions League era. And that's a shame. But I think that's the way of things now. Because, yeah, if this had been in the past, they simply wouldn't have been up against such quality opposition. They wouldn't have had as many games as well to end up in the mire. Several of them would have been easy. And then they'd have had maybe quarterfinals or so onwards would have been slightly harder. But you just simply wouldn't have got the sheer amount of drama. You still, obviously, in those days, you did get some, but it was a bit more sporadic. You think of like Liverpool, Nottingham Forest as a first round tie back in the day. You know, things like that. And I recall Madrid AC Milan as another early round one in the late 80s, I'm sure. And that's the kind of anomaly that the free draw threw up then. And that was good in its own way, but that's isolated throughout. And then, you know, the team that comes through that probably has a much easier ride through the next few games, which simply isn't the case here. So yes, Chelsea created a few of their own problems and created their scrapes. The mere fact of a group stage allowed them the time to overcome their first problems, which simply wouldn't have existed in the past. You know, Liverpool struggled against Nottingham Forest in that first round game, and that was it, done for that year. Whereas Chelsea had the chance to recover, and that's the other aspect of it.
It's okay, so we've established where the point of genesis is, Gary. We've got the rationale for writing it. Aidan's brilliantly answered that question with where it sits with regards to European Cup and Champions League. The thing that I want to come to and that sort of impressed me the most, it probably seems a bit trite, and I apologise for that, but reading it, the first thing that struck me is the sheer level and depth of research. It's, you know, it is an incredible amount of detail, minute detail that goes into this book and goes into the telling of this story. And I know we joked before we came on here that it was like an episode of 24, and it was practically, it must have taken you the whole season in real time to research it. But this is going to sound like a really rubbish question now. Did it take a long time to research? poor rubbish question for a big builder.
I mean, I don't know how long is long. I mean, I did go into a lot of research, a lot of detail in the research. And I did that in two ways. Firstly, by my own research, but I managed to get in touch with a group of Chelsea fans who I mentioned throughout the book, and I sort of tapped into their memories of the games as well to pick out various sorts of details. And also, I was fortunate enough to get in touch with a number of journalists of the day, newspaper writers and newspaper reporters and such like. And yeah, so yeah, I sort of tapped into their memory as well, which sort of added to the picture. I wanted not to skim over things because it's very easy. It would have been very easy, especially with the Champions League campaign, to sort of say, well, they got through the group and now here's the tasty bits. But even in the group, there was sort of crazy events. I mean, they lost to Bayer Leverkusen, I think, is the last but one game, and we're going out. They were going out then, and fortunately, Valencia fell over their own feet against Genk. And then Chelsea managed to beat Valencia in the last game to not only qualify, but to win the group. I mean, it was just even that. And I want to make sure I got all that those sort of details in. And obviously, there was this sort of issues with Vilas Boas, the rumpus between him and the players. It was a growing... There was the famous statement, the phrase used by Emanuela when Mourinho left about the palpable discord. Well, this was palpable discord times 10. You know, they say about coaches losing dressing rooms. I mean, this guy, he didn't even know where the dressing room was, let alone lose the contents of it. So there was this sort of problem between the players, and this grew throughout. And one of the guys I was speaking to on one of the podcasts earlier, he said to me, what was Di Matteo's biggest asset that he led to turn the team round when he took over from Vilas Boas? And I think the simple answer was, he wasn't Vilas Boas. Aside from the fact that he got a Chelsea heritage behind him, so he got respect from the players already, but there was the situation got to such a height there, and that was a key thing. I mean, the decline of the club was, as Aidan pointed out, they didn't even qualify for the Champions League for the following season. They finished fifth, and not even near to fourth, in fairness. And only qualified and denied top on their place because they're winning the Champions League. And there's so many things throughout the season I wanted to make sure I included everything. That's why I wanted to get not only my own research, but also speak to all these guys that I've got to were sort of willing to sit there and let me bore them with my questions.
Stephen, you've written your trilogy on Cup Winners' Cup, UEFA Cup, and European Cup. You know, and yours is very similar in terms of the level of research that goes into that sort of a story and that sort of a tale where you are chronicling a particular event, tournament, season, whatever it is. And the pressure that must be on you guys who write these sorts of books to get the detail right. Because as we know, there will be somebody who will either read it or will point out if actually it wasn't 3-1, it was 4-1, or actually it was scored with his left foot and not his right foot. Mm-hmm. So in terms of that, you know, if you're going to go down the road of the type of book that Gary's written, there then becomes an awful lot of pressure.
It does, because people are obsessive about these things. You know, we're obsessives for writing them in the first place, but there's people out there that, you know, might out-obsessive as if that doesn't even sound right as I said that, but you knew what I meant. You know, there'll always be someone out there who knew exactly what, you know, a player did or what they had for breakfast that day or anything like that. And, you know, it is a huge pressure to not drop the clanger of, you know, it's the wrong ground, it's the wrong player. It was the, you know, player scores in the first half and you say it's the second half. No, you've got to get these. You've got to be faultless in what you're doing. You've really got to be faultless. And to the point of, no matter what you think you remember, and you might well remember it correctly, you've still got to make sure that you remember it correctly. You know, you do have to go back because, you know, you can surprise yourself sometimes and think, the way I remembered that was nothing like it was. You know, or, you know, even if that's just once or twice in every 100. You know, it's worth doing because, you know, you have that peace of mind is that you've written this snapshot of history and you don't want to mislead the people who read it because you don't know. Someone could be reading that in 100 years' time and taking it for granted. I mean, I remember being on Twitter not too long ago and chatting with someone and yeah, I listened to the 90s podcast where he picked kind of like the England squad, hypothetical England squad for the 1994 World Cup. And I remember having a chat with him on Twitter and he was picking a hypothetical alternative England squad for the 1992 European Championship. And, you know, and I said, I was surprised that Graham Taylor didn't take Tony Adams, for instance. And he was kind of like, oh, well, he was injured. And I said, well, no, he wasn't. He wasn't injured. He was, you know, just not selected. And then he went and looked it up and he said, well, Wikipedia says, you know, so... So I put, Wikipedia says. But I said, no, I remember it because like Mark Wright was injured but didn't declare it and only declared it after the deadline. So they couldn't replace him. And I said, it's something that's always stuck in mind was that Graham Taylor you know, gave him a number 21 shirt, Tony Adams, as some kind of consolation, basically to say, you know, you'd have been there in other circumstances. And when you come to look it up elsewhere, he was kind of like, you're right, the internet's wrong. So, you know, you do have to get these kind of like little details. If you're going into minute detail, if you're going into the, you know, the greatest of detail, you've got to make sure you get it right.
That's great. What a great little anecdote, by the way. Thank you for that.
I know I am right and Wikipedia is wrong. I know it's not really hard. That's not hard, but, you know, it's
no.
Someone was actually surprised that I out Wikipedia. I need to go, Scragopedia.
You need to be careful, because anyone who's writing a book now, is just, your inbox is going to be flooded.
I am screwed. Oh, no, I'm not going to name who it was, but when we did the Liverpool magazine, and I had to vet absolutely everything that was written. And there was one article that I had to kind of like, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong. And I had to correct about 7 or 8.
I'm just trying to think what I wrote about for that.
I think we're all a bit worried about who was
I'm naming no names, and I'm not looking in anyone's direction on here. But you do have to kind of like get your facts right. You really do. You know, you can't say it's not just kind of like the obsessives that will pick you up on it. It is kind of like because you write a book, you are leaving a legacy. You are saying, look, here is a record of, you know, that competition or that season or that event or that play, whatever the topic is. And you don't want to mislead people, you know, because you know they'll go on and write something and they'll take what you've said for granted as being correct, you know. And you have to be absolutely, you know, scrupulous in everything that you do when you write something like this.
You are right. Aidan, I guess all these guys, well, as we're sat looking at the screen on this podcast, Gary and Stephen are below us. So the guys below us are sort of setting standards here for levels of minute detail for books. And if we decide to ever go into a book that requires minute detail, these are the sort of standards that have been set.
Yeah, why do you think my upcoming book is like separate stories and different chapters?
Well done, you.
So I can waffle on to my heart's content on vague themes around a topic without delving too deep. Yeah, I know. You're right. It totally came through, as you said, in reading this book, the sheer amount of detail. Not just for the big Champions League games, but for everything that came in between. You know, naturally slightly less focus on a 3-0 win at Fulham or whatever, but they all form part of the overall story. So you do need to know what happened there or what impact there was on certain players of things that have happened in these other games too, because that then obviously impacts what happens in the bigger games when they crop up.
You want to get your Aidan's right there. It's perfect because you want to get that element of the cause and effect. You know, it isn't just a case of turning around and saying, you know, Chelsea won this Champions League and they beat such and such and be, you know, if you can spot, there's a degree of pattern analysis to it. And, you know, it's kind of like working out the stepping stones. There's a degree of investigation about it as well, because there'll be little subtle instances, little deflections here and there, not just on a football pitch, but what's happened in the build up to games and stuff like that. You know, what was the landscape between one game and another that altered the kind of the pattern or altered, you know, the trajectory of what they were doing? You know, how did Chelsea come so close to losing, you know, the first leg of the last 16, or being blitzed in the first leg of the last 16, yet turn it around? You know, you're looking at what happened in between those two games, is what was the catalyst that made that happen, you know, or, you know, and these are the type of things you need to do.
And the beauty of it is you can put your slant as the writer onto that. So, you know, as Gary lived this season back at the time, and the other Chelsea fans that he's spoken to may all have differing views on what Stephen's talking about there, of what certain incidents triggered other things or what themes emerged. But, you know, Gary can collate and assess that and probably had his own ideas as well. And as much as Stephen says, it's like a record of that time, but it's also a sort of thinking analysis of it as well, in terms of you're offering up partly your views on events as well as just what, how it happened and how the trigger events, as Stephen was saying, what affected what. So you get to embellish it and add to it with that kind of extra depth. But yeah, the amount of detail that has to come in to be able to do that, to be able to pick out those themes, because it can't just all work from memory of a decade ago of all the finer details, because things will obviously get missed that way.
It's just to sort of add a little bit in there. What I didn't want to do in the book was just to be make it look like a catalogue of football results and so-and-so scored from the head in 47 minutes or whatever. This is why I wanted to get to feed in other people's experiences. There's 5 or 6 Chelsea fans that I spoke to, and the journalists, and also a couple of other people. I mean, a couple of our old friends from podcasts in the past, Brian Baldy. I was chatting to him. He just happened to tell me that he was he'd seen Torres score for Atleti against Barcelona at the Nou Camp on one of his I can't remember which birthday it was, and obviously I could feed that into the reflection of what happened in the semi final, and Seb Hutchinson was at a couple of games, and so to describe the action from his point of view, because he was actually in the ground at the time, and very similar to John Helm as well. So it gave a different colour to it as well. So not only was it just the facts as well, but it was how people saw it and the sort of emotion that left with them as well. Because that was all part of this, because it was a sort of emotional rollercoaster throughout the story. There was one incident as well, which I sort of only referred to very obliquely, which was the Ashley Cole being dropped, even though Billis Bowers said it was because of injury against Napoli. And strangely enough, actually, Basinga got injured about 7 or 8 minutes of the game, and Ashley Cole came off the bench and played the full game, sort of giving the lie to the assertion that he was injured. But ahead of that, I was talking to a very famous and very, very wealthy Chelsea fan whose name I can't mention. And he was in the same hotel as the club, and he was a couple of floors down from Villas Boas's room. And he heard the conversation and the reaction, shall we say, of Ashley Cole when he was told he wasn't playing. And that was just an example of the discord between the players and the coach.
You can mention it on here. No one listens to this podcast. There's only us four.
He does.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. I can't believe you just mouthed who it was, Gary, and now we all know. You didn't. I know you did. Sorry. Right. So, this is what I was going to come to next, actually, and sort of Stephen made kind of alluded to it in his discussion as well. It's one of the points I want to ask you. This level of detail and this season, and then I asked you at the beginning, would you have written this book if it wasn't Chelsea that had gone through this season? Was it difficult? Did you find that the research conflicted with your memories and emotions as a fan from that season?
I think the short answer is probably no, not to any great extent anyway. I mean, the very first book I wrote, which was I Don't Even Smoke, which was sort of published through Amazon self-publishing, as you know, sort of in those sort of early days of it, sort of reflected through that the book anyway. And when I look back afterwards, sorry, through the campaign anyway, when I look back afterwards, it was very sort of similar sort of feel to the flow of the writing. But what I wanted to do is not tell it my story of it. I wanted it to be a third person story as much as possible. Now, obviously, it's impossible to sort of totally vacate your to take off the blue glasses when you're writing, as you know, as much as you know Steve's not writing Liverpool or Aidan writing about Newcastle or whatever. But I wanted to get other people's stories rather than mine across, so it wasn't just me saying, "Oh God, I was sweating when this happened." And I don't think I actually mentioned most of the emotions in the game through the game throughout. I tried not to, so I hope I didn't. But I might have sort of, it might be intonated in the words. But I wanted to make it a third person description of the events, not a third person's, lots of a third per people, I should say, description of the event rather than mine. So, yeah, I don't think it was that difficult, in fairness.
I'll ask both you guys the same question then, Stephen and Aidan. I'll ask you first, Stephen. Are you considering writing a book about Liverpool? And if so, would you struggle to be impartial when writing a book about Liverpool? Bear in mind who all the listeners are and all the things that you say about other clubs.
Yes, I am writing a book about Liverpool. And yes, it will be difficult to be completely impartial about it. Because at the end of the day, it's your club. You know, you might feel like you're being even-handed, and I think you can probably I know when it comes to kind of like me writing about my own football club, is that I can be overcritical. I think that's what it comes down to. It's akin to kind of like the football manager who picks his son, you know, and probably criticizes his lad more than any other player in the squad, you know, and makes him jump through more hoops, you know, to prove himself. Yes, you know, so in that respect, you know, having tested myself about having to write about traditional rivals as such, you know, write a Cup Winners' Cup book and write an Everton chapter. You know, and one of the best things was that, you know, the Everton fans I know who've read that chapter have said that you've done it justice, you know, and to write about Ferguson's Manchester United in the Cup Winners' Cup book, to write about Matt Busby's Manchester United winning the European Cup. What you've got to do when you're, it's a completely different kettle of fish writing a book or a chapter or an article about a team that, you know, you are programmed to dislike, you know, and that's a hell of a challenge. In a way, it's harder to write about your own team than it is about your rivals, you know, because with a rival, you've got to look through the eyes of the supporters and say how would have this felt to them, you know, and then kind of like use your own experiences to kind of summon up that kind of feeling. So you can look at a team and an event and say, well, look, you know, if I was the supporter of that football club, these are the games, this is what how it would have, I'd have reacted, or they would have been the results in the games that would have made the biggest impact, and kind of mirror them against something that you've experienced yourself as the fan of your own football club. So the opposite route is that the danger is kind of, I don't know, just kind of over romanticising your own football team's achievement. I think the biggest trick is exploring the warts and the imperfections. And in this case, and in the case of the Liverpool book, I'm writing the dysfunctional side of the story, you know, and being able to put all of the, I don't know, the good with the bad, you know, and in that respect, it's not going overboard on the bad. You've got to find the right balance. You know, the good parts of it, you've got to kind of like make sure that it's set as I don't know, respectable and, I don't know, reflective level as it was for people who are reading it who aren't, you know, reading it through your eyes or the eyes that you've written it as. It's a huge task. It's a huge, yeah. But yeah, so yes, in that respect, going back to the question, yes, I am writing a book about Liverpool, and yes, you know, it offers interesting difficulties.
Aidan, for you then, based on what Stephen's just said, is your next book Newcastle's 10 Greatest Moments or Sunderland's 10 Greatest Moments?
Thankfully, neither. No, I'm not writing a book about Newcastle, and I don't think I would. While Stephen was talking there, I was sort of thinking it over of why that is. Partly, I think, is I don't feel as engaged or as passionate about it as I do about the subjects I do. I'm writing a book about, or have written a book about. As you say, you know, you mentioned, and this is one thing Stephen said several times, is you write, and Gary mentioned at the beginning of this, write something, the book you want to read. And the books I want to read are just as narrowly focused on my club. I want to read about other clubs. I want to read about other things, other events, or more global things. Now, if I'm just restricting myself, so many people in this area, as I'm sure is the case in Liverpool and London and whatever, are just so narrow-minded in their view of just the locality, and you know, the local team is the be-all and end-all of football to them. So when they aren't playing, there is no football. That, to me, I just don't get that. I do have a certain level of passion for it, but it doesn't take over like it does for some. And I think that's possibly why I would veer away from it. Another reason why I'd veer away from it is I think others have done books on the eras that I would possibly want to write about. There's probably only one real era that I feel strongly enough about in Newcastle's past that I'm engaged in, though I was aware of, and that's been done really, really well on a few occasions already. And that's obviously like the Keegan era of the 90s. Therefore, I don't think, for one, I'd have a topic that would actually engage me, possibly because we don't ever win anything and haven't really competed for anything for a long, long time. So we don't have the dramatic events like Gary's talked about in this. We don't have... I can only hazard a guess as to what Stevens is, but I guess it involves some sort of silverware with massive ears as well. You know, we don't have things like that. Maybe we will in the future, but I don't know whether I would feel as engaged enough to really delve deeply into that, as opposed to the topics that I do want to write about and get into. But we'll talk about more about that in a few weeks.
It's interesting. I'm just going to jump in there and suggest that Aidan does need to write his Newcastle book.
Yeah,
and we need one on Keegan the player, 82-84, and that promotion winning side. So yeah, I'll not rest properly until that's up and running.
It'll be an ode to David Kelly, and Robert Lee.
Interesting, Steve, as well, just to mention that unlike the books that Steve has written and Aidan, all of the books I've written, football history books, are about teams close to my heart, strangely enough. I mean, so is England, the Dutch team, and the Orange, Chelsea, and the one I'm working on now at the moment, which is Ajax. So, it never struck me that was the case before, but it obviously is. And so it's, I haven't sort of done anything any different, I suppose.
It is, well, like I say, it's what makes it interesting, isn't it? You know, sure. We all love football, and we all love it for different reasons, and we all find these things that we want to write about. But ultimately, the core of everything is, as all of you say, is that write something that interests you, and then you won't go far wrong. And I guess that's the difference. You know, what is it that actually interests us? With regards to the content, then, you know, the book, like I say, we've read it; it's brilliant, the detail, all of that sort of thing. But from your perspective, I suppose, now, Gary, the genesis of that side that wins the Champions League, obviously there's the influences of Mourinho, Villas Boas and Di Matteo at the end. But in terms of summing up for you, you know, getting into the content and the subject of the book, you know, you start it with the missed penalty, but in terms of that side, that Chelsea side winning the ultimate European club trophy, where do you think that started to form, or that could potentially become a possibility for your club?
I think there's two answers to that. The first one, I guess, is when Abramovich turned up and Mourinho turned up and started signing all these players, because quite a few of those players that were in the first crop of signings were in the team that won the Champions League in 2012. And I suppose the other answer, strangely enough, is when Villas Boas got sacked. So there's one very, very long ago and one very, very sort of near to the events, because the change when Villas Boas was in charge and they went to Napoli, scored first and considered three terrible goals. It would have been four if Ashley Cole hadn't cleared one off the line. Yeah, I mean, there was such a cathartic change in the situation when he left. I think it was after the West Bromwich Albion game, when they got Nchoska beat there, and Dimitar came. It was a massive change there. So I think there's two genoi. What's the plural of two starts. So we got the going back to the early part of the decade when Abramovich turned up and Mourinho started signing players. I mean, obviously players like Lampard and Terry were there at the time, and players actually came through afterwards from there. But so there's that. But I think the key thing was it was such a situation. I'm going back and reading all newspaper reports and talking to fans who sort of experienced the thing of doom. And sort of despair, and there's no way out of this. You know, it's going to be a terrible season, the worst season under Abramovich, and then that happened, and things changed so massively. So I think there's two answers to the question, right?
It's fair enough, and I'll come to you, Aidan, next. That Di Matteo, as Gary's just mentioned there, you have two Genoa masters, however you want to word it. But you have these two points, and Di Matteo seems to be, he isn't just the beneficiary of that. There's still so much more to do. But yet, you know, as Gary's pointed out, those are the two key moments. And then it seems, you know, to the untrained observer or the casual observer, that he just happened to benefit from the signings that Mourinho had made. That he couldn't be any worse than VS Boas, or he couldn't make the atmosphere any worse. So therefore, it was easy, but it actually wasn't, if that makes sense.
Totally. I think he was... those from the outside, we're looking at Di Matteo becoming a manager, and what had he done up to that point? Had he been at West Brom and nothing particularly astonishing about that? So that makes you assume from the outside that therefore... he didn't do much to earn this triumph, perhaps, or that, you know, the players rallied themselves and dealt with it. But it doesn't work like that. It never does. And I think reading this book, I jotted a few things down about Di Matteo, of what I thought of him and how he fitted the situation really, really well when you think about it, because I don't think he was ever going to be a long-term answer at Chelsea, because I think he was very close or too close to the players for a long-term answer. But that made him perfect for this situation, given what had come before. So given the Villas Boas era, the sort of breakdown in that trust and relationship and belief, I guess, and respect both ways, I think, because that was so broken, it needed somebody like Di Matteo, who was... the club, the fans would give him time and leeway because things were so bad before and because of everything he'd done in a Chelsea shirt prior to that. The players, too, had total respect for him because of all those things. Therefore, he was coming to a situation where the squad at that time almost needed the friend, if you like, to help galvanize things, to get things, to bring it together again, to make the group a group, to make it a team. It was sort of falling apart at the seams, and certain player characters were obviously strong ones who were rallying and trying to get things going. But it needs more than that. It needs somebody above it. And that made him absolutely perfect for it. He, you know, he won the confidence of everybody very, very quickly because he was able to knit the group together. I don't think, for want of a better phrase, an elite manager coming in from the outside would have been able to do that as well in that situation. I think longer term, they would have been better, sure. They'd have been a longer term answer. And over, you know, the course of a 2-3 year managerial career, they may have emerged stronger at the end of it than they might have done if Di Matteo had 3 years to go through. But in this situation, at this time, I think he was exactly the perfect character to do that for Chelsea. It's, you know, it's horses for courses. You know, just getting somebody from outside and almost starting again would have essentially written off that season to some extent. And sure, Chelsea may have surged a bit to finish fourth or third in the league, and that would have been good. It would have been salvaging something from what at the time appeared to be a wreck of a season, going really badly, and they were expecting to fall out of Europe at several points, but especially at that point after the first away game in Napoli, when Villas-Boas was gone. So it's a remarkable turnaround. I just don't think a manager who wasn't as embedded in the club, wasn't as respected in the club, and crucially wasn't one of almost, but so friendly with the players, I don't think it would have worked.
A quick question for you, Gary. As a Chelsea fan, is this campaign seen purely as Di Matteo winning the Champions League? Is there any acknowledgement of Villas-Boas at all, or is this just purely Di Matteo winning the Champions League Chelsea?
Well, I have to say, none of the fans, and in fairness, none of the journalists I spoke to saw very much, if anything, to praise about Villas-Boas. And one guy, I can't remember which one it was, mentioned that, he actually went to Tottenham after Chelsea and did exactly the same. Hadn't learned any lessons. Went in there and sort of, dropped a big rock in a pool and then was surprised when there were ripples. It was Di Matteo. The only thing that Villas-Boas contributed to that was causing himself to get the Evo and letting Di Matteo through the door. That was the only good thing that he contributed to the tournament, because there is no doubt in my mind, and one of the guys I spoke to sort of suggested any difference, that if he'd have been in charge of Chelsea when Napoli came to Stamford Bridge with a 3-1 lead, there's no way Chelsea would have turned that round. The belief wasn't there, the desire wasn't there, what's the word I'm looking for? They were sort of beaten down by circumstances, by lack of faith in the guy who was supposed to be leading them. You look at other things afterwards. I'm saying that Napoli, going to Barcelona to Benfica and beating Benfica at their home ground where they hadn't lost for about 3 years in European Championship, then come back to Chelsea, scoring twice, Benfica getting a man sent off, and then nearly blowing it in the last minute. And then you get the sort of the Barcelona ridiculous games, and then the Bayern Munich even more ridiculous game almost. If there wasn't that, I can't think what the right words, the belief, the commitment, the determination, the sheer dogged, cussing refusal to bend the knee to circumstances. No, it was all Di Matteo.
That's all right. That's a pretty comprehensive and answer. Thank you.
I didn't hit my bench there, did I?
Nope, not at all. Now, this question is really just for Gary and Stephen. I'm really sorry, Aidan. What does winning the Champions League or the European Cup
here we go.
mean to a club? I'll start with you, Gary. What's it like? What does it mean?
Good question. That's a good question. What does it mean? What does it mean to the club? It means to the club that they are one of the elite clubs in Europe. I mean, elite can be measured in many ways. But if you've won, the Champions League, the European Cup, whatever label you stick on it, is the premier tournament for clubs in Europe. So if you've won that, you've won the premier tournament. It's a good sort of illustration. Eden Hazard signed for Chelsea after they'd won the Champions League in 2012. And he tweeted that, "I'm joining the European champions." There'd be other clubs courting him. If Chelsea hadn't won the European Championship, the Champions League, would Eden Hazard come? I mean, I don't know, it's questionable. So it gives you a certain kudos. You're one of the elite clubs. And even clubs, when you look back at, and we've had this sort of similar discussion in the past, clubs like Nottingham Forest, they will always be, I'd claim a right to be in amongst the elite clubs of Europe. They've won the premier club competition in Europe. So I think there's that. It means so much to, Stevie's team, he's just said, me and Steve answered this question. Stevie's team won the European Cup more times than we've won the Premiership League, I think. Well, not if he hasn't gone far away. And it was such a massive thing, aren't we? I never expected my club to win the Champions League or the European Cup or whatever level is on it. But it is a massive thing. It means you've arrived.
For you, Stephen, Gary's answered it brilliantly, but from a club perspective, as a fan perspective, what does it mean to win that competition?
It's the pinnacle. You know, you are the champions of Europe. You know, Gary used the phrase. As a supporter who's been in the football ground when he's seen his team do that, I can categorically say it's the greatest thing I've seen. You know, as far as supporting my own football club's concerned. And that's having seen some pretty phenomenal things over the years. It gets no better, really. You know, the high of that is utterly phenomenal. To be those few moments, those first 10, 15 minutes after it's been determined are probably the plateau of any football supporter's, you know, supporting life, really. It's, you know, the most exhilarating of things. You know, I can remember being around Madrid and running around the streets of Madrid as well, you know, just a couple of years ago, and, you know, being lucky enough to be within the eye of that storm and then bumping into people that I'd known for years, you know, just unexpectedly. I didn't expect to see them, and suddenly there they were. And to be able to live that 10 or 15 minutes after that final whistle and share it with people that, you know, that mean, you know, a great deal to you was just the greatest of things. You know, it truly is kind of like just the biggest high for a football fan. And, you know, doesn't matter how many times you win it, I don't think either. You know, it stays as pronounced as it did the first time around, because I suppose after you've won it and once you relinquish it as well, there's always that sense of, well, will we do it again? And, you know, it could be the following season, it could be 20 years, it could be never. You know, so I think. From my perspective, every time I've seen Liverpool win it, it's almost like you embrace it as if it's the first time and the last time rolled into one. It's just the strangest thing, you know, and that even that, you know, just doesn't do it justice. You know, I'm only scratching the surface there.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, because, you know, as you've said there, you've been in a ground when they've won it. Now, we've all seen it on the television, whether it was in the sort of late 70s or whether it was two or three seasons ago. Is it surreal? Can you?
It's eerie. It's really, it's
do you
eerie.
Imagine? Yeah. Do you find yourself imagining, what does this look like on TV? Or, oh, I know what this looks like, I recognize that moment. Or is it where you just say, I cannot believe that this is playing out? Because obviously you don't get any replays, you get nothing. You just get to see it once only. And
you do.
But
what it is there's a great phrase that Bob Paisley used when he won in 77 at the banquet, at the winner's banquet in the hills of Rome. And everyone was offering him a glass of this and a glass of that. And he's like, no, I don't want to drink anything tonight. He said, I just want to take it all in. I want to remember everything. And, you know, there is this, I don't know, you become almost, I know from my perspective, probably not, you know, you ask this question to, you know, 100 other people, you might not even get the same answer once. And that every time it's happened and I've been there, I've been very conscious that I'll not live these moments again. These are bespoke moments, and you want, you know, your memory's trying to record as much as possible to be able to remember. And, you know, you're not thinking about television. You're not thinking about, you know, anything like that. You know, you're not thinking about back home or anything like that. You are just living that eye of the moment, that eye of the needle, that eye of the storm. And really, for those 10, 15 minutes afterwards, once that final kick, whether it's a penalty shootout, the final whistle, whatever it is, you know, there is this, I don't know, it is literally like the eye of the storm. It's the most amazing thing.
Can I just say, Stu, I mean, obviously when we won, it was the first time we'd won it, and in this story. And I mean, I'm not ashamed to say I cried. I mean, I cried when I watched the replay. I cried when it was on the news. I cried when I watched the play back afterwards, and I cried the following day as well. And I think
I've done a bit of that. No shame in it whatsoever.
No, absolutely.
And that's the thing. I mean, I remember Istanbul and looking around that end and everyone, you know, people who didn't even know each other. And you just knew that you would never forget the people that were surrounded by that day. And, you know, the tears that flowed were just part of that. Yeah.
I think that as well, what made it sort of more, I mean, for me, it made it more emotional was the fact that we've been so close to being kicked out so many times, and you'd almost give it up, and then you stand on the precipice and you're going to fall off, and then you just get back again. And there's that emotional roller coaster. And even the final was crazy stupid. And you play, we won it by beating a German team in a penalty shootout. I mean, even that you didn't expect to do that. And it was the first time. And you know, like Steve just said, but I mean, you know, Steve's team won it 6-7 times, and I didn't think Chelsea would ever win it again. I didn't. I mean, I didn't even win it that year, let alone again. So it was, I mean, as a fan, it was, I don't know. I almost can't. I mean, Steve's, I like his phrases, like in the eye of the storm, it was everything's going mad around you, or in your head. That's that sort of thing, that realization that something you sort of hoped for but didn't expect to happen and never looked like it was going to happen, suddenly has happened. Amazing.
There's as part of that as well, although it's all going off, there's a great clarity. It's almost like, you know, you are kind of within this hurricane of celebrations. But, you know, even now, you know, I can very vividly remember, you know, experiences and senses and, you know, all of that from, you know, whether that's Madrid or whether that's Istanbul or whatever it is, even going back to kind of like Paris and Rome in, you know, 81 and 84 and stuff like that. I can, you know, the stuff I can't remember from earlier today, but there's stuff that I remember, you know, from those occasions that will stay with me, you know, indelibly forever.
I probably should just point out Aidan's left the podcast.
I know. I'm just happy if Newcastle win a game. And they made me cry on a number of occasions in the past, but it's never in victory.
I've got to say, when people say who just part, I say I don't support a team, and I justify it, and it's great, and I love the fact that I don't. These are the conversations, and these are the moments where actually, I'm really disappointed in myself that I don't, because that I'll never get. I will never ever experience those, and I know I won't. Those moments will never come to me. And as much as I love football and all the stuff that football can offer, I'll never get it. And that is the trade-off. I am aware of that, and I'm aware of that trade-off. But it is listening to you two chat then, and I'll start thinking like, yeah, I will never ever. Football will never make me feel like that.
It's a strange thing. You feel blessed. You know, it's as close as you can feel to feel it. I always remember coming back from Istanbul and about 2 days later stood in a queue at cash machine behind what were two, I can only presume were two Man United fans. And they were chatting about the game while they were waiting for their turn at the cash machine. And they were just saying how amazing it was. And they were even saying, you know, it didn't matter because, you know, it was Liverpool. You just got, you know, so they got so drawn in by what was happening that they couldn't even kind of like, you know, be distraught that we'd won it, you know, that they, and they were begrudgingly kind of like, I was made up for them at the end. No, and I stood there thinking I could step in now and say I was there, you know, but I thought, yeah, and I didn't, but it was just one of those kind of like, yeah, it was just, yeah, you feel blessed in those moments.
And I'm assuming, obviously, you were equally magnanimous when they came back with two goals in injury time against Bayern Munich, and you were also having the same conversation with a friend at the cash point.
I did nothing. I did nothing. I'm not that magnanimous.
Okay, so in terms of Gary, I think I'm sure I've asked this question before, but it feels a bit more pertinent to ask you it again. And you may feel differently from the last time I asked you, but Chelsea winning it as the Champions League, would you? Oh, here we go. I'll rephrase it this way. So you've now won the Champions League twice. Would you sacrifice one of your wins to have just won the European Cup once?
I'm going to answer. I mean, there's three possible answers to that.
You can't have loads. But
No. There are three possible answers. Okay. There's yes, there's I don't know, and there's no. And I'm going to go with all three of them. Because the first thing is, I don't know, because my team's never won the European Cup, so I don't know what that experience is like. And I know it's a different competition because, you know, it's pure champions. We've discussed this, as you say, a number of times. So I don't know what that would feel like. Would I swap it? Yeah, because I'd like to experience that. And would I swap it now? Because we're still champions of Europe, no matter how you got there. So, I mean, there you go. So you've been sitting on the bench. The three possible answers, I've gone for all three of them, mate.
Stephen, all right, I'll ask you this. I'm really sorry, Aidan. I will ask you a question at some point soon. I am really sorry. Stephen, you've done both. Obviously, do you have a preference? But does it mean more? Do you think, as a Liverpool fan, it means more to have said, and Gary's right, you're still European champions no matter what, but does it mean more to be able to say that you won the European Cup rather than only to be able to say you won the Champions League? Please be careful who you offend.
I will tread carefully. What I would say is that you can only be European champions under the terms and conditions of that year's tournament. Yeah. So Chelsea's success came under the Champions League. And that's just the way, you know, the time scale of football panned out. Yeah. I would say from a Liverpool sporting perspective, you know, winning the Champions League, such a high, you know, I was old enough to be there. That's the difference. You know, I wasn't old enough to be there, you know, in 77, 78, 81, 84. I would say, from that Liverpool sporting perspective, though, those first four shine brighter than the next two, than the fifth and the sixth. You know, but there's a trade-off in that. You know, the highs involved in winning the Champions League those two times were incredible because, you know, I was old enough to appreciate them on a completely different level. You know, for 2005, I was there all the way along the trail. I was there for that incredible night against Chelsea. I was there for the Juventus game, you know, Olympiacos. You know, I can remember the spikes of emotion throughout all of those. You know, it's different watching the game as an adult to watching it as a kid. You know, the years will fall away watching it as an adult as these things happen. You know, I will still turn around and say the greatest thing I've seen at Anfield ever was the comeback against Barcelona, you know, the 4-0. That goes against everything I'm saying in that the first four shine brighter than the last two. So, you know, there is a give and take. There is a trade-off between the two.
I think it's worth saying, I flagged it up earlier, that the European Cup is more difficult to qualify for. We won the Champions League. We played two German teams. We played two Spanish teams. There was no sort of playing the champions of Albania or all that sort of thing. So I think it's more difficult to qualify for the European Cup. The Champions League is far more difficult to win, as that sort of Aidan mentioned earlier.
Yeah, the European Cup, there was that thin ice element to it. You know, well, you're walking the tightrope, you fall off. No, it's snakes and ladders and hitting the snake on 94. You know, it's that type of thing. You go back to square one and start again. And square one is winning your own domestic title to get there. So there was that, and you know, as I've written in the you know, the trilogy of books, is that different feeling. The fact that now in the Champions League you have so much European football that it has taken a certain gloss off that kind of, you know, you don't have that sense of the unknown or anything like that. But the trade-off is, you know, some pretty incredible. I always say that contemporary football, modern football is still great, but it's a different type of great, to, you know, a different type of wonderful to what, you know, it was back in the day.
Aidan, thoughts?
Well, in my vast experience of such things, I think when Stephen's talking there about how the first four of Liverpool's many European Cup, Champions League wins shine brightest, I was wondering whether that's in part just due to the passage of time. You know, we talk about this in context of what's a good World Cup and what's not, and it has to be at least 20 years old to count as a contender for being good in your mind, because it needs time for all the realities of some of the poor bits to sort of fade from view, and you only get left with the rosy memories. And, you know, the way three of us on here might think about the 1982 World Cup in that context is, you know, there were dross as well, but we don't remember that because it's all just about the great bits and the beauty. I'm wondering whether there's an element of that when it comes to valuing those, or they shine brighter rather than value. I think I like the way Gary put it about harder to qualify for the European Cup and harder to win the Champions League. I think there was just it's all become a bit too samey to me nowadays. And this alludes to a bit what Stephen was saying about how it's a different kind of good. The quality of the Champions League is phenomenal. Don't get me wrong. The drama of the latter stages are incredible, but it's the same every year, more or less. You know, there's very little change about it. And to someone without a vested interest in it, that gets a little bit blasé. You just don't really care that much anymore. To those in the thick of it, I don't want to sort of do anyone down of how much you celebrate and how much you get wrapped up in it all, because that's what you should do. That's your team in the latter stages of the most prestigious club competition that there is. But to the casual observer, I think the European Cup had greater prestige because it was harder to get into, and because therefore it was just, you know, it was England's best pitting themselves against the very best elsewhere. It's not just the same collection who get to go in it year after year, and therefore are the only ones able to get the players who want to be in it year after year. I think it's lost a lot of that, and therefore I would value the older ones more. But the success is harder now, as Gary says, and therefore the achievement is, if anything, greater in some ways, because there's more to overcome. But I think, to me, maybe it's just because I like looking at the past more than the present when it comes to football, that there's a bigger gloss about that.
Just jumping in on that there, I would say that even as a kid, you know, those four European Cups, 77 to 84, you could get that sense of enormity about what they'd done to do that. And that included, you know, that inclusiveness of having to win your league title to do it, and then pick your way through the minefield of, you know, and especially if you were there as a regular and you knew the pitfalls. So, you know, there'd be a Dinamo Tbilisi or a CSKA Sofia or a Nottingham Forest that had derailed you, you know, in other years. So, you know, when that was the thing, that you'd pick your way past on the successful routes. We picked our way past a CSKA Sofia. We you know, a Benfica, a Borussia Mönchengladbach, a Saint Etienne. It made those successes all the huger. You know, they glowed. You know, and that's the thing about those is, so when it comes to the contemporary and that feeling of kind of like, you know, the further back they are, the more that they glow, that doesn't tend to work with the Champions League, because at the minute, as mad as it sounds, 2005 and everything involved with it, and the trip to Istanbul and the coming back from 3-3 down to win it on penalties and all of that, at the minute, you know, 2019, you know, under Klopp and going to Madrid and stuff like that, the comeback against Barcelona feels infinitely better than 2005 did at the minute. So they, it works in a convex way with the Champions League. It's almost like the most recent ones mean more, whereas with the European Cup, it's the ones that are further back that mean more. So even within those four that you win, 77, 78, 81 to 84, you know, it's almost kind of like, it's strange the way it works. You know, it does have a reversible kind of aura about them almost.
Obviously, for me, that's never a problem. I'm ever going to have to worry about which ones do I prefer and which ones shine brighter. Gary, like I say, the book is phenomenal. And it, again, it's, yes, it will appeal to Chelsea fans, of course it will. But people who love football stories, people who love outrageous stories, people who love the fact that sort of fact is stranger than fiction, minute detail, you know, it has absolutely everything in it. You know, it is, like I say, it is, in the detail is incredible. The amount of things that I learned, knew nothing about or forgotten, hadn't remembered, all that micro detail, as Stephen and Adam were both saying. The micro detail is so important, not just about who scored with which foot, but the whys and the wherefores, the moments in between the games are actually, as the guy said, you know, more revealing and more interesting than the actual games themselves almost. And, you know, and that's obviously all credit and testimony to you. You know, the book is wonderful. Congratulations on another one.
Thanks, mate. You know, thank you for those very kind words. It's very nice to hear. And I hope anybody listening in sort of says, well, yeah, I'll have to go out and buy that. So it's on Amazon now, pre-order, out on April the 11th.
Yep, got it.
Yeah, so thank you for those very kind words.
not a problem at all. Like I say, and to give it its full title, out of the blue, Chelsea's unlikely Champions League triumph. I have a passion for book titles because that's the dull life that I lead. However, out of the blue, how long did that take?
Well, originally I wanted to call it Rhapsody in Blue because that was sort of stuck in my mind. And but unfortunately, there's a book out. Another pitch book out called that about 6 or 7 months ago. It was in sort of process then, so that went out the window. And I was just sort of toying around with ideas, and I just think it works really well because, I mean, it came out to the blue, and obviously blue for Chelsea. That's where it came from, and I just think it probably works better than Rhapsody in Blue anyway.
Like I say, I think it's great. It just seems so easy. And so, such a natural title. I thought you were going to say, oh, yeah, I just thought of it while I was having dinner. Just one of them things that fell out. Stephen, great book. Obviously, like we say, I know you're not yourself. You've sort of self-confessed you're not magnanimous at all about other people's European Cup trial.
That is another side effect of it, is that, you know, when it's like, yeah, it looks wrong when it's in the arms of someone else. Once you feel like that trophy is yours, then it does look infinitely wrong within the possession of any other team. And
Real Madrid fan thinks about Liverpool.
Exactly. You know, so that's Liverpool from a Liverpool perspective, winning it six times. God knows what Real Madrid fans feel like.
Gary's book then. Did you even bother reading it?
Honestly, yeah. don't just read it. Buy it, and then read it. It is a wonderful, as ever with Gary's work. It is a wonderful, wonderful piece of work. The detail in it, you know, it is just beautifully crafted. You know, just go and buy it.
For you, Aidan, obviously, again, as same, well, even more so for you, it's just one of them glimpses into the window of what could be. Yeah, potentially now, what could be?
perhaps so. You never know. But it is a fantastic book. So much detail, so much depth. Brings it all hugely back to life. Obviously, with it only being a decade ago, I remember many of the events, I think, quite well, but obviously not in this kind of detail. And there's so many extra bits that came back to mind that I'd obviously stored away somewhere at the back of my brain. And neglected, and then they came vividly back to life with reading the the excellent descriptions and the excellent themes of this book. And to me, Chelsea is, you know, it's not necessarily the first team you think of that appeals to neutrals, perhaps. They're sometimes hard to love in terms of some of the characters, possibly, and some of their history, perhaps. That's probably unfair, but I don't think there's anything necessarily fair about football tribalism, and that seems to be a bit of the way when it comes to Chelsea. But this team and some of the characters in it, if you neglect some of those who may be less popular, the Terrys and the sort of Lampard leaves me a bit cold. I think he's a bit aloof. But people like Drogba, he appeals on so many levels, I think. And, you know, that's the kind of story that his redemption, as Gary said, it started and it ended with Drogba. Well, the Terry kick and Drogba, obviously it was a result of Drogba being sent off. And then he comes through, he scores the epic equaliser towards the end of the final with only minutes to spare. And then he scores with his final kick until he started to come back a few years later. His final kick for Chelsea at that time. He's somebody who you can get inspired by, who you can, I don't want to say relate to, obviously, but, you know, feel an affinity to as a neutral observer. He's somebody whose extra drive and passion and ability and strength and determination is something that appeals across the board. And this Chelsea team had a few of those kind of characters as well as the ones that we all love to hate. And therefore, I think there's plenty in here that appeals to the neutral rather than just a Chelsea fan, is what I'm belatedly getting around to saying. And therefore, it's a fantastic book. I really enjoyed it, brought it so much more to life. And exactly, you can forget about Terry because he missed the final, and we can just concentrate on Drogba, who we all love.
I've got to say, I love Frank Lampard. I actually think he's better than Steven Gerrard.
Well, I just find him really quite aloof. He's an interesting guy.
If I was in control of this podcast, I would have cut you off by now.
Nah, he is.
Especially with Everton manager as well now.
like I say, Gary, one point, you know, congratulations. It is wonderful. It is out of the blue. Well, not that you've written another book. Your book's just called Out of the Blue. It's the 11th of April. You know, like we said, even if this is just a taste of what it's like, it is so much more than we've had time to cover it. It is a wonderful piece of work. Congratulations, my friend.
Thank you very much indeed, guys. And I much appreciate all those nice words. And yeah, I'm sort of quite comfortable now that my stag do is over. So I'm looking forward to yours, Aidan, in a few weeks. So
there you go. See, one down, some more to go. All that's left for me to say is please join us again next time on the Lob podcast with these football times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.